Well, good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning.
This is the Film Experience podcast, which you know since you're listening. But it's an important one because it's the first podcast we've ever done since everyone was in the same room together.
I know.
It's true.
History being made again.
Katie and Nick sound somehow more intimate to me now.
I know. We know each other on a new level. It's really exciting.
I've seen the whites of her eyes.
We've bonded over pizza.
Yeah.
Katie, how long did you stay again?
I left Toronto Wednesday afternoon.
You still had a week there.
Yeah. Oh, it felt like a very long time. Like, I know you guys made it to the bitter end, but honestly, Monday morning, I was like, I could go home right now. Which I'm glad I didn't because I saw some very good movies after that. But yeah, it was, that is a long time to stay at a film festival, what you guys did.
So how many movies did you see, Katie? Because I know you had other duties. Like, we were just seeing movies mostly.
Yeah. By Monday and Tuesday, I was also, like, I saw, like, one movie on Monday and kind of cut down. I think I wound up seeing about 16, which is pretty good, I think. So yeah, I feel pretty good about my track record. How many movies did you see?
I saw 29, which is the record for me. I know it's nothing compared to Nick, and probably not even compared to Joe.
Yeah, I saw 33, which definitely up from my 25 last year.
I saw 47, but I don't have
my God.
I don't have to write anything.
Wow.
Just tweeting away.
And how many of them were over 3 hours?
I think only one.
Oh.
You're slacking.
Yeah, I got myself under control this year.
Or maybe the filmmakers did.
Or maybe the filmmakers did.
Well, but then three of those were one movie, 1 6-hour movie in three parts.
That's true.
So there's that.
So technically, you could argue you only saw 44, you slacker.
Mm.
Okay, but technically two of them were shorts programs, so you could actually say I saw 60. Yeah.
Actually, that's a lot of restraint you showed in not saying 60.
Right? Yeah, it's true.
Katie, we haven't heard from you about what was your favorite thing at the festival, because I pulled both Nick and Joe.
I think I'm going to go with Room. I know that's the audience order, which makes it kind of the easy answer, but I really loved Room. And then I wound up seeing Spotlight, which I didn't catch in Toronto, but saw in New York. And I like Spotlight a lot, but I don't think it doesn't top Room for me. I'm very much on the Brie Larson Room bandwagon, as I think I've written about it. No, I've only written about it once this week, but I feel like I'm already becoming the one man band for A24.
How expected from a female critic to like
Room. Yeah, especially when Jeff Wells hates it makes it so much more fun to get behind.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really enjoying this so far.
I love the term feminized man, though.
I know, I'm going to wear that.
No. I mean, Jeff Wells, for all of his insane opinions, he can turn a phrase like that you will never, ever forget.
Yeah, I mean, I've been called a lot of things in my life, but feminized man was a new one for me, and I will take it.
Yeah, I think you should wear that.
I love that movie.
I have a replica of Da Vinci's Feminized Man hanging in my living room. It's gorgeous.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Sicario.
I still have yet to see it, so that's
No. Okay.
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot of...
Maybe you could ask us questions.
I will. I look forward to hearing you guys talk about it.
What would you like to know?
So I've heard such a wide mix of reactions, which is why I really want to see it. Like, my colleague Richard Lawson saw it at Cannes and was not that crazy about it. And then a bunch of reviews out of Toronto and other places were just ecstatic. And the thing that I'm super curious about is Emily Blunt's role really good? Or is it a bunch of dudes mansplaining terrorism to her? Or not terrorism, but drug cartels? Well,
I love the framing of that question. It has a lot of judgment in it.
Well, I've heard both in like really convincing ways, and it's really been unclear to me like what I should expect.
I think it is both, though, and I think a bunch of dudes mansplaining the drug war to her is part of the movie and part of her sort of narrative arc, and the movie doesn't endorse that as much, although it does. There's a lot of like, this is the shitty way the world is in this movie, where it doesn't really offer as many solutions to that as you might like, but it's clearly aware of it, and it's clearly, you know, it's not endorsing, you know, I think Emily Blunt's movie is easily the protagonist of the movie, the sort of our window into things. We see how insane everything else is in this world through her eyes, And I mean, there's definitely not a sense of, oh, this poor little girl needs to like learn things quick. It's like, oh wow, learning all this shit is terrible.
Okay. And so it's like the Ethan Hawke in Training Day role, like the you're seeing the window into the world.
It is, but she's even more sort of paralyzed by how awful the stuff that she's seeing is. Mm. And nobody's even, it's not even quite like luring her in so that she can get indoctrinated into something awful the way that he is. It's like they just need her as a crutch that allows them to like prosecute the case and make it look like they're doing one thing when they're really doing another. And if she pieces all that together, she just has to be like, I don't know, you like that last scene in Monster's Ball where they're on the porch and Halle Berry has learned the truth and she just can't even, like, nothing's happening with her, and but she's just, like, stupefied. Like, Emily Blunt has to be in that space for about an hour. I thought she was amazing in it. Like,
yeah, it's I agree. It's the tricky part, though, and now that I've seen it, it's, you know, I'm realizing why people are not completely on board with her, because people often have trouble, you know, separating performance from role. And it is, in some ways, a passive character.
Another question. I don't want to structure this as a Q&A, but I thought about this too. I couldn't really stand Prisoners. Am I going to like this movie?
I liked it way better.
I think it's much stronger in terms of filmmaking.
Well, I guess it would depend on what about Prisoners... The
overblown nature of Prisoners, like the fact that all the characters had names that don't exist in the real world, and everyone was kind of cranked up to 11, and it was like mostly metaphor, not story. Like, I just, Prisoner did not do it for me.
And there was a cat lady who lived on top of a big subterranean dungeon.
Wait, yeah. You don't think those people really exist?
Keller Nover is not a name a human being would have. And Detective Loki.
The subterranean dungeons make a real comeback here, but everything else, I would say, as does incredibly handsome photography, but everything else, I would say, is pretty different.
Cool. I like that.
Yeah, but he's definitely got a thing for subterranean.
Yeah.
I mean, for a drug war story, that seems to make sense, actually. Seems like a more suiting place for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, another great thing about the subterranean thing is it can be literal and a metaphor.
So we're still heavy on the metaphors in Sicario.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you look at his short film that Nick and I both are ecstatic for, Next Floor, which was one of his big short films, it also has that sort of, like, going down through multiple layers, which becomes a...
That's true, I forgot.
A metaphor for entering hell, basically.
The production values, though, just seem like they get better every time. Like, it's... Prisoners already seem like a really handsome movie to me, but this is just off the charts. Like,
it's Deakins again, right?
Yeah.
It is.
But it doesn't feel like Deakins to me, in terms of the... it doesn't have as easy of a way to pinpoint, oh, that's a beautiful Deakins shot, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't feel as self-conscious as something like Prisoners to me, in terms of this is going to be an exciting shot to look at. Or am I wrong?
I felt like there were moments when it was that, like having to shoot people in incredibly low light occasionally, which I feel like he's really good at doing. But then I sometimes feel like the Deakins shots tend to be pretty interspersed, even in a lot of his movies. Like, this felt like Skyfall to me, where sometimes it was like, this is so elegant, I can't think about anything else. And then other passages where the camera is not really calling attention to itself. But that was just me.
Okay.
It feels like, in retrospect, I remember a lot of sort of moving the camera around through things, which, I don't know, like, it was just incredibly gorgeous and kind of, but not, gorgeous is the wrong word to use, I think, because it is, it doesn't, to me, I never really felt like I was being moved to be like, eh? Like, how pretty is this? Like, even through, like, ugliness and stuff like that. It just felt like it was very much sort of moving you through this world.
Well, I mean, one thing that I really loved about it which I can't figure out exactly why I loved it. Maybe it was the sound design, but like a lot of the sh of the shots of like a lot of the outdoor shots of just like vastness of space, like the desert and or the tops of cities or things like that, where it was very not, I don't want to say monochromatic because it wasn't like drain all the color as I hate in cinema,
I
but what
said
it
to myself,
I'm
sorry.
sorry, go ahead.
I was saying to myself, how are we supposed to know that this is taking place in Mexico if it's not all yellow, washed out, like sepia
Right.
tone? Like, I don't understand. You're not holding my hand through this thing.
Yeah, but I mean, it's shooting things that aren't by their nature super colorful, but it didn't feel like that purposeful washed out, you know? But
Yes.
it's still, there was something about it that I just, like, the images were just so compelling. I think it may be of the combo of the sound, though. Which, because Nick, your tweet on the sound, I'm like, oh, 100%.
Oh my God. Like every once in a while, you're just watching the movie, Katie, and then you hear a sperm whale pass underneath you. You're like, what is that? Like just some crazy huge rumble. You don't know where to look. Something's happening. It's the
Huh.
score is
The score is amazing.
The score's
The
really
score
good. Who did the
and
score?
Johan Johansson.
Oh,
Yeah,
okay.
the theory of everything guy, and there's not a
Yeah.
single thing you would associate between those two scores. Like
Yeah. That's
it's like
exciting. There's a
Yeah,
scene
I
sort of early on after one particular the first after the first sort of big set piece that takes place at a border crossing. And then that night, the characters sort of look out over the city and watch the sort of like these flashes of gunfire and these flashes of police sirens. And it's sort of over this wide ranging city. And it's basically just like looking at the chaos that this particular police action has caused. And it's just this sort of like side-to-side canvassing. And I'd never really seen something like that depicted in that particular way that I thought was very interesting and kind of there's a few of those moments of stepping back in this movie I really liked.
Well, and yeah, and the sort of amorality of showing us those moments in those ways where you're not going to give us any context and you're going to be like sort of smug about it as some of the characters are, which I thought really added to the movie's sort of moral quagmire.
What does smug about it as in like I've seen all of this shit and I'm over it kind of
Well,
thing?
you know, like the mansplaining characters, like they're very, very superior. Like the movie's not, as Joe was saying earlier, the movie doesn't like flat out endorse them, but it also doesn't, you know, disabuse us of their notions. But they are really gross about it all the same, even though the movie's not judging them really for feeling that way.
There's a lot of this movie where Emily Blunt's just like, tell me what's going on, and they're just like, no.
Jesus.
And there's just a lot of that. There's just like there's an o opacity to the people, the sort of the Josh Brolin, the people on his level in this that, you know, and that's part of the story too, where it's just sort of like, you know, there is a wall up from what people at her level and her partner are able to even just be told exists.
One thing I was curious about how you all felt about was the action sequences, because it was only after the movie was over that I started thinking about how the action sequences aren't really action sequences. Like the border crossing sequence, which you think of as a set piece. And it's really, it's filmed like a set piece, but when it comes to the actual violence, it's a very sort of stacked deck and it's over very quickly. And yet it has all the tension of like a long act, you know. A long sequence where things are actually happening. I'm wondering how you guys felt about that.
And that's paralleled with the thing at the end too, that I obviously am not gonna describe, but there's a scene at the end
Right.
that mirrors that type of thing where it's just like you know something's coming, you're waiting for it. That one has a the one at the end has a little bit more of that kind of classic movie, I'm gonna make a speech before something happens thing that is not my favorite thing, but the one earlier on at the border crossing was really very tense, and tense as built up through different types of shots and different sort of angles on what's happening and what's about to happen that I really liked.
And also, like, it's an action sequence, Katie, that's all premised on a traffic jam, so no one is moving.
Yeah.
And so there's that. And as they've, it's not too much to say that as they've gone into Mexico to perform their first major sting, I don't know, I'm probably using the wrong words, they've all been told, like, you probably won't get any pushback while you're doing this, but when you try to come back into the States is when all hell will break loose. So there's the total possibility that those, in the same way that Nathaniel and Joe were saying, like, that the smug kind of givers of wisdom all along, you're kind of waiting to find out, do they really know as much as they think they know? Because, boy, are they sure they're right that this is when everything's going to go to shit. And then it kind of seems like nothing's happening. And then it seems like probably something is. And so it's pretty exciting, but also which characters you are putting your faith in is kind of hanging in the balance of what does or doesn't go on. I thought it was really great.
Yeah, I was really impressed with it. It kept me the whole time, and I really thought I would not be excited about it because I am not a big fan of miserablest, you know, violent drama. But I thought it was very, very exciting, and I liked all the sort of complicated characters without... I felt it didn't ennoble the anti-heroes, which is one of my big problems with the violent crime dramas.
Yeah.
Because even if it's even if it's not, you know, disagreeing with them, it's also not like, wow, they're just noble people in this hell. It didn't feel like that at all. Like the way a lot of gangster movies feel.
In fact, even less as it went on, I think.
Yeah.
Though I do think Brolin's performance kind of asks for a level of sort of audience approval because he's so, like, he's going for this sort of dark humor and sort of, he's playing this sort of, like, ridiculously cocky character, but he's definitely playing it for laughs a lot of times, and you get... I don't know, there was a degree to which I think that character was trying to get more audience sympathy than I think he deserved. I don't know, I could be wrong.
Did you guys like the relationship between Emily Blunt and her coworker friend?
I did.
Her partner?
Yeah. I was confused about what their roles were because it seemed like he wasn't supposed to be there, but he was always there, which threw me quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I liked their rapport a lot, and I thought it was unusual for a movie because it wasn't sexualized or romantic at all.
Right.
Yeah.
But it also didn't... I thought it was interesting.
Well, he spent so much time talking about how she needed to... refurbish her appearance that I kept thinking they might be springing a boyfriend of his on us at any moment.
Right.
No, I liked their working relationship. I liked that they were the two people who each could fully trust. It made me sort of realize that, like, all of these movies where you can't trust anybody and the main character could get turned on by their closest friends at any time, it really makes me value a movie where there's a relationship where it's just these two people, and they're the only two people who they each can trust to be completely honest with each other, in part because they're the only two people who are as in the dark about everything as the other one is. And I liked that.
I also like that we kind of get a sense of how largely impersonal the Emily Blunt character is through a personal relationship, like rather than all that bullshit where we go back to her imaginary apartment and are like, ooh, she doesn't have any kids. There's nothing on her fridge. Oh, there's that girl next door who comes over sometimes, but that's all she's got. Like, there was none of that crap. Like, you just got that, you know, we hear she's divorced. That's all we need to know. But, I was impressed with that.
Yeah, it's very economical.
Is this Sicario, though, where, like, we, like, three guys mansplain to...
No, this... So, okay. The whole mansplaining thing, like, I think you guys put it into a really fascinating context that, like... And I kind of enjoy that a movie, like, has these kind of despicable characters. Not despicable, but, like, questionable characters, but doesn't need to go out of its way to kind of condemn their behavior. But I just think if, like, Prisoners was so macho that I just didn't know how this movie having a female lead in this like super male heavy world was going to work. But you guys, I think you guys have convinced me.
It's sort of like those scenes in Silence of the Lambs where Jodie Foster is surrounded by a bunch of guys who are twice as tall as she is. Mm-hmm. If imagine a movie that has to sort of stay there for a long time.
Yeah.
Maybe even the whole running
if it's going to stay there permanently.
And make something of it. Doesn't just have it there. Yeah.
But maybe with Prisoners too, like I felt like Hugh Jackman's increasing macho, vengeful explosiveness was like so not over the top in terms of how he played it, because I thought he was great in that movie, but like it seemed clear to me that the movie knew that he was a problem. But nothing, you know, if you wanted to watch the movie and just be totally behind him and see this as like a father's grief and anybody would do this, the movie wasn't gonna stop you. This feels similar to that to me.
Which is smart. It's playing to all crowds.
Have we all seen Stonewall?
No.
I sure have. Oh. I'm the only one of us who saw it at Toronto.
Oh, I saw it at Toronto, too.
Oh, you saw it at Toronto. God, that was the weirdest screening.
It really was.
Tiny little room.
And people were really worked up about it.
Yeah.
Did people get as angry about it as they did in the New York screenings?
No.
No, but they were really worked up about, you know, the fact that they couldn't find seats. And
oh, they were worked up about the screening, not the movie.
No, nobody's ever been more angry about anything than the New York critics were about their screening of Stonewall. I will say that.
Oh, you went to it here?
No, but I was like, the reactions to it afterwards.
Yeah, people really walked out of that screening with knives out. Which, from what I hear, the movie deserves, so.
But a movie.
I mean, in a way, like, I hope I'm not seen as an apologist because I gave it a terrible review myself, but in a way, it's just dumb and not hateful. Like, I honestly, like, I hope you guys read my review because I'm proud of it, but, like, I really feel like in some ways it's like an idiot savant movie.
Yeah.
Because it really does provide you all these really super easy visual metaphors for what we're always trying to talk about that Hollywood does wrong. And so it's like very illustrative.
Like it's doing the things wrong that we're always talking about. Like it's like an
example.
Yeah,
and it's doing them in really easy to understand visual ways where you can just like stop it. I'm not a teacher, but I kept imagining myself in a classroom hitting a freeze frame on the DVD and explaining, look right here, and you get your laser pointer out and you have like this perfect embodiment of everything that's wrong.
So like what? Like what's a scene that does that?
Like let's just rather not have to like read into the plot or break it down thematically, let's just have a moment where the people of color are like, actually, white guy, you would be better at this than us. Could you do it? I know we taught you, but maybe you're like,
we trained you, and I know we brought the weapon that's going to start the whole gay revolution, but here, why don't you take it and do it?
Oh, God.
And also, you've been to this bar like twice, and we've been here a long time, so whatever everybody's mad about, which is actually not defined, like, we're the ones who would be mad about it. But you go ahead. You seem angry.
But it goes even beyond that, I feel like, in just the sort of the dunderheadedness of it. And if you're going to take a metaphor like the first brick, which has been sort of talked about and debated over like for years, to put it in the hand of your apocryphal, you know, white character, you don't need to have the fucking metaphor then. Like, you know what I mean? Like, your movie didn't need to have a first brick. You know what I mean? If you're going to put it that way. Like,
That's a great point, and part of why, I mean, I totally relate to what Nathaniel, you're saying about, I thought that movie was terrible and feel slight twinges of protectiveness of it, because there are moments where I feel like you see it trying not to be stupid, and like the beginning of the riot, where it's really not clear who it's assigning, like, where's the moment where the riot becomes inevitable, and there's a lesbian who's being arrested, not for the first time in the movie, that has been set up as a real figure of audience sympathy, and she's really pissed that all these men don't care when stuff happens to her. Mm-hmm. Marcia has a role. Like it's like doing all this cross cutting as though everything's coming together at once, and you're like, oh, okay. And then it's just like, but really though, Jeremy Irvin got really mad. Like, okay, like.
And really unconvincingly mad. There's, you're right, like, which one of you, I think it was one of you, had said that the movie seems oddly uninterested in the riot itself?
That was me.
Which is incredibly true, and it's incredibly, and just in, not just in terms of time spent in the movie, but, like, the way that it so easily is pivoted off of to, like, back home in Indiana, and it's just so, it's such a strange little movie. I think that's part of the reason why I have gotten a little frustrated with sort of this game of can you top this in terms of how angry we can be at Stonewall and in the discourse, because, like, I really want to go back and talk about just the bizarre choices made in this movie and the ways in which just, like, every possible, you know, bad decision could have been made, but they are ultimately filmmaking decisions. And yeah. I feel like to sort of put this on, you know, Roland Emmerich's toxic worldview of masculinity and whiteness in the gay community, like, I guess, but, like, part of it is just that I think he's just made just this series of incredibly dumb choices, informed in many ways by, you know, the way a very mainstream blockbuster director thinks of things like casting and thinks of things like audience surrogates, mm-hmm. is incredibly, like, diseased and toxic, but in a way that, like, I think transcends specifically a lot of the complaints, a lot of the sort of, like, social complaints that are made about the movie.
Yeah, the way he talked about why he brought in Jeremy Irvine and why we needed him as an audience surrogate, I was like, oh, this is just a guy who's been in studio meetings for 20 years, yes! hearing about how you have to have a white guy in the lead role. And it didn't occur to him that he would get personally blamed for it. He was just like, that's just how movies work, and that's how I made my movie. Mm-hmm. And, like, it doesn't mean he should just settle at that. Like, he's smarter than that, but, like, I totally saw where that logic was coming from in his weird mind.
Well, yeah, and I mean, the other thing that's so frustrating about that in terms of compounding your mistakes is, like, not only does they have to be a white guy, which, you know, whatever, if you remove the brick and you want to make it about this group of people, there are people of color in there, whatever, you know. So you could technically have made it more of an ensemble movie that was less offensive and still had your white guy.
Yeah.
If you remove the brick, and also if you also don't make him an outsider, because this is what Joe and I were talking about, this, like, it's a, you know, all civil rights dramas at their core are stories of community. And so whenever you make them about one person, you lose the story of the community, especially if that person is an outsider. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever to what you're Absolutely. Trying to get across.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But just to go back, I just want to say, too, that I totally, Joe, agree with you that I was expecting something kind of in a Bagger Vance vein that was like, this whole thing is premised on a really odious, you know, conception of, like, race and power and the way we're going to tell stories. But on those terms, it's going to, like, hum along perfectly fine, and I'm just going to hate it.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that actually this was, like, a disheveled, badly directed, like, nobody's decided why they're telling this story or what they want to do. Like, it wasn't like, here's the Hollywood studio machine that has now pulped Stonewall into this gross thing that it can attract a big audience to. It was like, here's everybody's weird, did everybody on the crew fight with each other? Does nobody know how to talk to each other? Like, why does no decision add up with any other decision? Why is every performance dialed up too high?
Yeah.
Why are we in Indiana twice as long as we were in the riot at the end? Like, there's a whole sequence at the end where the guy goes back and is like, has anything changed since last I left here? Has there been any dramatic movements? And everyone's like, no, it's exactly the same as the last half hour you spent here. And he goes, okay. And then he just goes back to New York. And it's during the three additional nights of the riot. Like, we do that instead. Like, what?
Well, and yeah, and the other thing that it's worth noting, because, like, Roland Emmerich is taking all the blame, is this was also written not by him, but by another gay man.
Yeah, John Robin Bates.
Who was a legit theater playwright.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what you say, not theater writer. Thank you.
So, like, I don't... Yeah, the whole thing, how bad it is, how ill-informed the choices are, it's not just Roland Emmerich's fault, but also it's like, what were they thinking?
Well, and sort of to Nick's point, too, there's an odd kind of silver lining, maybe, in that this isn't going to be that insidious kind of movie that plays to the audience you don't want it to play to and reinforces falsehoods that you don't want reinforced. Like, nobody's going to take anything from this movie because it's so poorly made. Like, I can't imagine, like, straight audiences coming to this and then walking away being like, yep, thank God for that white guy, or else started. Like, they're going to walk out just as befuddled and kind of, like, repulsed as the rest of us are, because it's just such a bad movie.
So are you saying that we'll get a real Stonewall movie eventually? Should that be a thing we want? Like, this does not prevent a better Stonewall movie.
Nobody is going to be like, well, they've already done Stonewall, so I can't get that out. Like, no, absolutely not. We won't get it. Like, this is going to bomb, and it's going to be, you know, a cautionary tale in terms of, like, studios not wanting to put money into something like this. But eventually, somebody's just going to, you know, tell this story in a way that's not stupid.
I honestly think that it would require a different medium. Like, I think that Hollywood will take the message that, like, gosh, they weren't happy with anything. Like, you know, we really tried, and they were mad before the movie even came
out. Can't make the gays happy.
Exactly. Like, also, I can imagine, like, a Broadway musical or a... I can imagine a musical or a miniseries being like, let's really do this in a different
Stonewall miniseries would be awesome.
But I don't see how another feature would get funded within a generation to try again.
This is probably the only one who saw the other feature of Stonewall.
It's sitting here and I still haven't watched it.
There's another narrative?
Yeah, it was from 1995, I believe.
Oh, no, but I was going to say this is probably where we should recommend Stonewall Uprising. The documentary?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing that I thought was interesting about this, and I don't mean interesting in a complimentary way, is when I first saw the trailer, you know, when everybody else was all upset about the brick, which the trailer hints that that's the way that scene's going to work out, but it's not super explicit about it. It turned out the movie confirmed everybody's fears. But is that the plot is extremely exactly the same, which I don't really understand, because if you're telling a story about Stonewall and you're fictionalizing it, how do you end up with the same plot? Unless John Robin Bates and Roland Emmerich really liked that 1995 movie.
Because is it any good?
It's much better. But it's basically the plot is a guy not from New York, a white guy, comes and, you know, this befriends this drag queen who wants to sleep with him, and they sort of have a relationship but sort of don't, and he ends up sleeping with the guy from the Mattachine Society who's trying to convince him, no, those, you know, those drag queens and those hustlers are a problem, blah, blah, blah. So it's like all the same beats, except for it's not odious and it doesn't give the white guy credit for starting the gay revolution.
Because, and is there hopefully no scene where the white guy says to the unrequited lover, like, but you know we could never be together. Like, we're just
no,
so
they
different.
Actually do sleep together in that
Okay.
There's sort of a couple, but not like a serious couple.
That was the grossest line in Stonewall, though, wasn't it? Like, obviously we could never be together.
In the other version, they are, like, boyfriends very briefly, but it's just not, you know, he's just not that into it, you know?
Hmm.
And then because the other guy's a lot more like him or whatever. But it has all those same beats of sort of like the triangle and even, you know, the guy from the Mattachine Society. So it's like, since this is fictional, why are you stealing the original movie's story and making it worse? You could have told any story if you were going to fictionalize it.
That is a strange choice.
It's like, you guys really should see it, because it's much better. I mean, it's super, super low budget, and you can feel the low budget.
Yeah.
But it feels a lot more authentically gay, and it doesn't, like, the main character doesn't ever really become the white boy. Like, he is one of the main characters, but it's basically like as if this version of Stonewall, as if the Johnny Beauchamp character had been the co-lead.
Okay. Crazy.
So you guys, I really want to see what people think of it, because I was surprised at how few people seem to know it, even. Because whenever I bring it up, people are like, what are you talking about?
Well, and Joe, you were going to say about the documentary.
Oh, yeah, Stonewall Uprising, which I'm actually not even sure if it was a theatrical documentary. I know I saw it on Netflix.
It was, briefly.
I saw it around the same time as I saw How to Survive a Plague.
Yep.
And they sort of told this very complimentary story. How to Survive a Plague felt very kind of East Coast, although it obviously covered more than just that. How to Survive a Plague felt sort of, you know, West Coast in its, you know, it covered a lot of San Francisco and stuff like that. Stonewall Uprising felt very East Coast in its sort of New Yorkiness. And it told, I think the two of them together told this very kind of complete story about these sort of early gay political radicalization movements.
So go see a lot of things other than Stonewall, is what you're saying.
Yeah, see lots of other things.
See Sicario other than Stonewall.
Go see Roel Emmerich Shakespeare movie, which I like.
I will say also, though, a lot of people have been pointing out Johnny Beauchamp as the sort of one sort of lone bright spot in the Stonewall cast. He was so good on this season of Penny Dreadful, mm-hmm. and that show was kind of not for everybody, but highly recommended if you want to go back and watch that.
Yeah, and he's already typecast, so...
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, I was having a hard time thinking of the performance as good.
Yeah?
I couldn't get too worked up about it. There are so many moments when, like, everything that character says has to be way up here and goddamn, you know, like that even just saying, like, hey, where are you going? You know? It just seemed like a real sort of, like, hot-headed person of color, like, was stereotype was informing a lot of choices. But then Jeremy Irvin's frequently yelling things that you would think would just be conversational dialogue and
I don't know.
Shouty movie. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers doesn't shout, but then I'm not sure he can.
But he can sure do Handsome and Sinister, which he's done for like his entire career.
He's good at it.
It's weird, though, that they had J. Edgar Hoover show up towards the end, though, right?
Oh, my God. And then, like, pussyfoot around about whether that's really him or not.
I couldn't believe how close they walked up to the door of, like, that actually being him. Like,
they have J. Edgar Hoover, like, show up at, like, as a patron at Stonewall?
No.
No.
It's a very J. Edgar Hoover-esque man who, like, is a John for one of the, for the character.
Oh, wow.
But yeah. How poorly negotiated was that entire subplot? Like, why was any of that happening? Did you guys understand that?
Astonishingly terrible. But all facilitated by the Ron Perlman character, who the movie sets up relentlessly as a child murderer and an exploiter and a racketeer. And he's sort of responsible for this happening. And then at the end, there's a title card that's like, this character actually turned out to be a really good guy in real life.
What?
Yeah.
And all in the movie, in service of making actual Stonewall seem like the most hellish place on earth, like I wanted one moment where you could see what this place meant to anybody.
Oh, even and they enjoyed being there, yeah.
As a, like, well, it's, you know, shoddy, but it's what we've got. Like, not even that. Just, like, everything that happened in there seemed just so terrible.
Yeah, so you guys really need to see this other Stonewall movie, because it's so much better the more we talk about this one.
So, can I pull it back to Sicario? I know we don't have that much more time, but just because the issues are related, like, I was looking last night on Twitter, and Noah Tsika came back from Sicario and was like, I can't believe how loathsome that was.
Yeah, this, I saw that.
Completely Donald Trump vision of Mexico, this movie feels racist to me. And I have to say, it didn't strike me at all that these questions of representational politics that are dominating our conversation of Stonewall, I don't mean just the four of us, but everybody's, I haven't heard a lot about that with Sicario, and I was kind of amazed that it hadn't even crossed my mind to entertain the question. I think I felt like the movie was so informed by having a point of view that is that of the, like, militarized U.S. drug war that I understood all of its vision to be conditioned to how these guys see the world. But then I worried that I was being too easy on the movie. Like, what did you guys think?
I had a hard time relating to that criticism, but
okay.
I was expecting it to bother me, but it didn't bother me in the same way that Hugh Jackman's character didn't bother me in Prisoners, because mm-hmm. I didn't feel like anything was endorsing. I thought everything was just point of view.
Uh-huh. But then it is odd that we have, there's one character who I thought was a really interesting screenwriting risk, who's this Mexican character that we spend a few scenes with occasionally.
Yes, totally.
In his home environment, totally other from the rest of the movie's point of view. And then eventually he gets looped back in. Which only seems to show that, like, the movie isn't entirely encompassed by one point of view. But now I want to go back and look at how much of its kind of portrait changes, if at all, when you couldn't say, well, this is because this is how the FBI sees Mexico.
Mm-hmm. It did seem risky the whole time it was happening. I was like, how does he factor in? And then I thought it was oddly touching because, you know, it seemed, the whole situation seemed so inescapable for everybody within the situation.
Right.
Whether or not they had good intention.
Yeah, I agreed. I guess it's the thing that when I rewatch Sicario, which I wanted to do anyway, just because I was so blown away by the filmmaking, I'm going to have more of an eye on, because it wasn't even part of my initial response.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this time. So definitely of these movies, you should see Sicario.
but did that come through?
But please do check out the original Stonewall, because the actors are better too. It's the original one has Frederick Weller as the white boy from out of town, and he's a very good.
Is that the character name?
No, white no, that's the
town.
Actor,
the white boy from out of town. Yeah,
he yeah, he's a good stage actor, but he's been in a few movies, but Frederick Weller and Guillermo Diaz are the stars of that one. And it's a lot more of an ensemble piece, and a lot more of, it feels a lot more New York, even though it's like ridiculously low budget.
Mm.
Thanks, everyone.
It's like Stonewall has stupefied us.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what more to say about it.